From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Today we're talking identity, how we see ourselves, how others see us, and what happens when those views don't match up.
Being Mormon and gay are both intrinsic to who I am, and trying to stuff one is like holding a beach ball under the water.
Then we'll take on gender identity and meet young people trying to figure out where they fit in a binary system.
I was just this little girl trying to figure out where she really belonged and, like, if she was a she and stuff like that.
And we'll hear what racism feels like in 2013.
What? Don't all Japanese people do that? Or a joke related to sushi, samurais, ninjas, anime, you name it.
Stay with us for Cross Currents. Recently on Cross Currents, we aired a profile of Oakland's Mormon Temple, an architectural icon in the city and a place that's very special to a man who was married there.
A marriage performed inside a Mormon temple is declared to be for not till death do you part, but to also carry on into the eternities. So if we were to hold the wedding across the way in the regular chapel meeting house, it would be until death do you part. Here, my wife and I were married in this temple in 1975, and the words were, because it is in this sacred and holy place, we hereby make the marriage one for time and for all eternity.
The discussion of marriage hit a nerve with listeners. We received dozens of comments on the story, many of which called attention to the Mormon Church's role in opposing same-sex marriage during the fight over Proposition 8. One commenter called the church the epicenter of anti-gay political activity dedicated to demeaning and marginalizing homosexuals. A self-described Mormon responded, "I do nothing of the sort and have great love for all people, regardless of their sexual orientation." The Mormon Church, officially known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has played a big role in opposing same-sex marriage in California. Its members contributed heavily to anti-Prop 8 causes and continue to do so.
My name is Mitch Main. I am an openly gay, active Latter-day Saint, or a Mormon.
Main is executive secretary of the Mormons Bay Ward. That's the local chapter of the LDS Church. And he's been doing everything he can to combat the bad feelings that the Prop 8 battle brings up, even bringing a group of straight Mormons to last year's Pride Parade.
I was scared to lead a bunch of, you know, straight Mormons out marching down Market Street because I mean, this is the hotbed, right? This is where Proposition 8 hit home the hardest. And I've felt the heat from the LGBT community personally.
Clearly, Main is not what we think of as a typical Mormon. He describes himself as an ambassador between the church and the LGBT community. He spoke with KALW's Stephen Short about how he fell into that role and what it means to him now.
I actually remember when Proposition 8 hit California and the Mormon community as a whole. I was a member of the Oakland First Ward in the East Bay, up in the Oakland Hills. And I remember the letter being read across the pulpit asking the Mormon membership to do all we can to help make sure that this bill achieves what we want it to achieve. And it was a really terrible, trying time. I mean, resulting from that, what happened, Stephen, is a lot of the membership, a lot of the straight traditional members left here in California. And I think that's a blanket statement that can be made across the United States. It just didn't feel right to so many members to lobby for a piece of legislation, not anything religious related, but a piece of legislation, a piece of public policy that discriminated so much against another set of humans that already had, you know, big enough trials in life. And I had come out to pretty much everybody in the ward, and they welcomed me with open arms and said, "Yeah, kind of big, no surprise. You know, you're a Mormon guy who's white and, you know, fairly attractive. You got all your teeth and, you know, you're over the age of 23 and you're unmarried. So it's, you know, kind of obvious." My stake president approached me and said, "Hey, you know, we had a really difficult time, you know, across this entire stake, which encompasses many congregations, wards. I want to begin to heal that rift. Will you help me? Will you help me by at least speaking at some of these presentations that I want to make in each of these congregations?" And I said, "Absolutely." So that's sort of how it began for me. And I think within just a few short years, maybe 2 years, we had had, you know, 15, 20, 25 different events combining the Mormon communities and the LGBT communities, stretching everywhere from Oakland Hills clear out into Davis. And what that said to me was, not only is the LGBT community ready to start having a dialogue with the Mormon community, but the Mormons are way ready. It's like, we want this to be over. We want this, from the Mormon standpoint, to end. We need a resolution here. This doesn't feel right to us. We don't want to exclude people. These people are our neighbors. Many times they're our family members. They're people we love, and they're people just like us. And we want them to feel that.
People identified as Mormons are marching now in gay pride parades. I'm wondering if anybody's chanting, "We're here, we're Mormon, get used to it."
I'm not sure that that's going to be chanted, but the thing – actually, I just got an email this morning from a group in Salt Lake City who is organizing the Salt Lake City Pride Mormon Pride participation already, and I think that's absolutely fantastic. I think we can look forward to, you know, 500 Mormons coming out to march in Salt Lake City Pride this year. There's a large faction on the Mormon side who are uncomfortable with this. And there are a large faction in the LGBT community who are also uncomfortable with this. And I hear from both of those. Those are both pretty vocal communities. And what this boils down to for me is, you know, for many years, I tried to live my life as a Mormon man without being gay. And I was miserable. That did not work for me. And then for a number of years, I tried to live my life as a gay man without being Mormon. And that was equally miserable for me. Being Mormon and gay are both intrinsic to who I am. I look at both of them as parts of my spiritual DNA. And trying to stuff one is like holding a beach ball under the water. You can do it for a certain amount of time, but eventually you're going to let it go. And when you let it go, it's going to pop up out of the water with some force, and it could hit somebody in the face. So both of these communities have very strong opinions about how I should live my life. And the bottom line for me, Stephen, is the only opinion of me that matters more than my own is that of my Savior. If I am right with Him, then nothing else really matters, because everything else will just simply fall into place.
Is that what gave you the courage to do this?
What gave me the courage to do this? By and large, yes. What gave me the courage to do this is, if we look back at my history with you know, being in the Oakland First Ward and having a partner and wearing a wedding band and teaching Sunday school and not just being accepted by my Mormon fellows, but celebrated for who I am and fully included, invited over for dinner with my, you know, bring your partner, we're doing X, Y, and Z, or we're, you know, having a ward picnic and, you know, make sure your partner comes with you. And I had a really, really charmed Mormon existence. I had the kind of Mormon life that I bet you really, really lucky straight couples have in the Salt Lake City area. And what gave me the power to do what I'm doing today is, when my relationship with my partner ended, I found myself in a position to be able to help create what I had as a gay Mormon for other people. And that really mattered to me. I don't think that I could be, in order for me to genuinely show my gratitude to my Savior for what I got, I need to give back. And this is my chance to do it.
That's openly gay Mormon leader Mitch Main speaking with KALW's Stephen Short. We'll hear more from their conversation in a few minutes. And we also want to know what you think about the Mormon Church and same-sex marriage. You can join the discussion at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Stephen's conversation with Mitch Main got us thinking about identity, how it's expressed and where the conflicts are. And we wanted to hear from some people who are figuring out their identities and how they affect their daily lives. Mills College student Skylar Crownover sent us this commentary about the way people perceive gender and how it affects a very basic part of the day.
As I stand in the bathroom, hands soapy under the hot water, I can feel their eyes burning holes into the back of my head while they try to decide what might be between my legs, as if it's any of their business. I have never understood this impolite and intrusive behavior that has followed me throughout life. When did society deem it okay to recheck the sign on the door when you walk in and see me, or to directly say, I think you're in the wrong bathroom? There has been no change in the force with which this question hits me as it repeats itself at 7, 10, 15, 18 years of age. In a society that insists bathrooms are based on biological sex, you are not allowed to ban me based on my gender. I wish I could say that this was uncommon, that these were isolated events, isolated to me. But bathrooms pose an incredible challenge to transgender and gender nonconforming people. When I was 10, I used to sneak into the men's bathroom because it was easier. In the men's bathroom, I wasn't questioned. It was freeing. But that is no longer a safe option, so I am forced to endure the accusing, disgusted looks. Bathrooms are not the place for society's microscope. A little privacy, please.
That's Mills College student Skylar Crowniver. That sense of feeling out of place, we heard a lot about that while putting together this show. Nico Summers recently shared his story with producer Noah Miller of San Francisco's Out Loud Radio.
What I can remember from sixth grade through eighth grade was the boys asking me, why aren't you hanging out with the girls? Because I would always hang out with the boys, and they would get annoyed, they would get angry, they would get intimidated, and they would get scared because there was a girl playing with them, and girls aren't supposed to play with boys in middle school, you know? Especially in sixth through eighth grade, you know, boys are, like, staying in their own pack, you know? Like, they don't let other girls in. And the fact that I wanted to be like them, the fact that I wanted to be a boy like them, was so confusing to them that it was like, you know, just get out of here. Just don't interact with us. We don't have time for that. Hi, my name is Nico, and I have two moms named Elizabeth and Sally. Sally is Caucasian, and Elizabeth is African American. And they've been together for 35 years. They have 12 children. I have 9 brothers and 3 sisters, 13 including me. So there was always around 3 or 4 of them living with me at a time. Yeah, I have a very big queer extended family. So I live in a Victorian house, which has many rooms. And me and 3 of my brothers shared a room. I would always see my brothers working outside with big power tools and, like, all this cool stuff, like, digging up lots of dirt and, like, their muscles going and, like, throwing the ball for the dog and just doing all this stuff. And I always grew up around that, lots of masculinity. And I was just this little girl trying to figure out where she really belonged and, like, if she was a she and stuff like that. At first, I came out as a lesbian because I wanted to keep my femininity and I wanted to keep every part of me that was feminine. And I didn't really know what trans was. I was kind of timid to what that would be for me and what that would be like. But because I was attracted to females and I saw that my brothers were always bringing over girls, and so I thought, well, maybe I just should be a male. As my brothers moved out, I became really more comfortable with myself and who I was. I had to go through people teasing me about, you know, not dressing my gender, not looking like my gender. I started becoming more aware of, you know, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And is this okay? Is this right for me? The fact that my parents kept encouraging me to do all these things and to keep myself involved, it was hard for me to feel like I was not supposed to be doing it, because 2 of my most proud supporters were supporting me with this.
Nico Summers is a youth leader and producer at Out Loud Radio. He spoke with Out Loud's Noah Miller. If you or someone you know is 24 or younger and is interested in taking part in the Youth Media Project, go to outloudradio.org or contact Out Loud Radio on Facebook. How do you think about your gender? Has it changed over time? You can tell us your story at 415
415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now let's return to our interview with Mitch Main, an openly gay leader in the Mormon Church, who describes himself as an ambassador between the church and the LGBT community. He spoke with KALW's Stephen Short.
How unique is this role of ambassador between the gay world and the straight world in the church?
It's extremely unique. I think it's pretty safe to say that I am the only one, at least the only LGBT Mormon in a priesthood leadership position who is doing this. And that's okay, because I think all it takes is one at first. Really, the bottom line, Stephen, is if you look at our Savior's gospel, if you look at his ministry, he was chiefly concerned with what people considered to be the outcast of his days, the prostitutes, the money changers, the lepers. And, you know, he didn't have particularly harsh words for those people, but he had a lot of really harsh words for people who judged them and condemned them and chastised them. So to those who are challenged by the idea of including LGBT members among our Mormon community, I would encourage them to think about what our Savior really stood for. There are a lot of people who look at Proposition 8 and think, you know, what a terrible thing it was for the Mormon church to be involved in that and how much damage that they did as a church. And I'm not so sure I disagree with that. I think the Mormon church deserved the black eye we got for our involvement in Proposition 8.
In my readings of statements on your personal website and other related ones, I get the impression that the new outreach from the church is their version of hate the sin, love the sinner. Is that accurate?
I'm not sure that that's entirely accurate. I'm sure that there are those who would interpret it that way, but I think that among the members, there's recognition that this isn't something that we choose, and this isn't a sin that we choose to commit. Being gay just isn't a sin at all.
But now, again, speaking of terms, Elder Quentin Cook of the Church's Quorum of the 12 Apostles is quoted on your MormonsandGays.org website. And I'd just like to play that.
But let us be at the forefront in terms of expressing love and compassion and outreach to those. And let's not have families exclude or be disrespectful of those who choose a different lifestyle as a result of their feelings about their own gender. I'm sorry that I feel very strongly about this, as you can tell.
It's clear to me that Elder Cook is choking on those words. It could be compared, I think, to Ronald Reagan not being able to utter the term AIDS back in the 80s. I realize this is a big change for a man of Elder Cook's generation, but it doesn't come across as very sincere.
Given the statements that have come out of the church hierarchy in the past about anything LGBT, I think this website as a whole marks a huge improvement. And you're right. It is so far from perfect. You know, I have to be honest, when someone first sent me the link and I got the link to MormonsandGays.org, and at first I thought it was a renegade site because it used the term gay. And the Mormon community has never used the term gay. Certainly the official Mormon church itself has never used the term gay. So for me to have clicked on this and to found it as actually a legitimate site sponsored by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that was a huge first step. And yes, I mean, people like Elder Cook and other elders, they are going to stumble. They are going to have a challenging time as we continue to learn about this. I think what's so great about this is showing the willingness to be able to learn. It definitely marks progress. It's based now upon complete loving attitudes, complete inclusion acceptance to not, I mean, there's counsel specifically on the website to not break up your family over this. Don't kick your gay kids out of the house. Don't exclude your adult gay children from holiday gatherings or family gatherings. And that message has been sorely missing inside a church where we think families are so important. I was very happy to see this.
If we got into a time machine and went back even 5 years, could you imagine that you would be doing this today?
One of the things I said when Bishop Don Fletcher asked me to be part of this is to be part of the bishopric is I have never imagined, especially as a gay man, to you think that I would be any sort of priesthood leader within the Mormon Church, because that just is sort of off the table. That's like, you know, being an astronaut or also I think it's important for you to understand that, you know, we have 40 years inside the Mormon Church of misunderstanding what it means to be gay. And when kids realize, and they're realizing at younger and younger ages now that they are gay because there's so much attention being paid to it in the media, and there's so much more access to information than we had 40 years ago. So kids are knowing at earlier and earlier ages that they're actually gay, and you know they're coming out to their Mormon families, and because Mormons don't understand it, we are not equipped to respond. And as a result, the LGBT youth suicide rate for Mormons is, in most estimations, 4 to 9 times the national average. We don't manage the universe, so we don't really know what the outcomes of any given action are going to be. That's not to say we shouldn't always try to choose the right. We sure should. But sometimes our biggest screw-ups can turn into our biggest successes. This might be one of them.
Mitch Main is Executive Secretary of the Mormons Bay Ward. That's the local chapter of the LDS Church. He spoke with KALW's Stephen Short. You'll find a link to this interview and all of our stories at our website. It's kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Today we're exploring identity, and now we're going to hear from some young people who are navigating that terrain and figuring out how they want to act. Students at Washington High School in San Francisco's Outer Richmond were recently asked to respond to the question, "What was a time your identity mattered?" Our producers went out to Washington to hear their answers.
Hello. My name is Joey Yasuhiro. I'm 18. And I am born and raised in San Francisco, California, and I attend George Washington High School. There was a specific incident that occurred in Modern World class 2 years ago, when the class discussed Pearl Harbor and the beginnings of World War II. When our teacher brought up the underlying reasons behind the attack, a few of my classmates jokingly blurted out, "Why'd you do it, Joey?" The class had a good laugh at this. But right then and there, I got very, very upset. I replied, "And what does all that have to do with me, huh?" Our teacher told everyone to be quiet so we can move on. But I was still infuriated and also saddened by moments such as this. In the past, I've had stereotypes thrown at me left and right. What, don't all Japanese people do that? Or a joke related to sushi, samurais, ninjas, anime, you name it. I thought that with age, we teenagers would eventually respect these sensitive and controversial issues that often pop up in school. But on that day, I realized that it would reoccur in harsher ways infrequently. It was a big slap in the face. It was a sinking feeling where I could not escape the seemingly endless cycle of discrimination. I am constantly labeled for what my people have done throughout history and not for simply being American. In fact, when my uncle studied in North Carolina, he once had a stranger go up to him and say, "Why'd you bomb Pearl Harbor?" What is almost funny, but also ironic, is how the general public leaves out how the war even ended. Hell, I could ask the same question about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and expect either a half-witted explanation or a complicated one that leaves them pondering. If this type of incident were to happen again, I am confident that I will handle it with class. It is futile to resist against the onslaught of stereotypes and racial jokes, so it is best for me to accept these comments, but also myself. For a long period of time during my childhood, I felt ostracized. I had an identity crisis between being full Japanese and being American. But in recent years, I've been able to adapt to my surroundings and form my own unique identity. I also found that defending against others' scorn of me meant to defend my own heritage. It became an awareness of my culture that would eventually become a fascination of its own. Now, I can freely express my culture to others at school without fearing any kind of insult. As I have said many times before, I'm an American who is so Japanese. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Winnie Zhao, and I'm 17 years old. From grades K to 4, I attended a private school where most of the people, that being staff and students, were white. I noticed that most of my classmates' parents were often involved with school activities and their child's schoolwork. I wanted my parents to do the same, but they couldn't because their English was very limited. I always tried to get them involved, like chaperoning for a field trip, which they did a couple times, but when they did do it, I would feel embarrassed because they couldn't keep up with what was going on, as horrible as it is to say. It wasn't just when they were at school that I felt uncomfortable, but even when it was just them and me. There were simple things like reading or filling out forms that got sent home that made me feel like I didn't fit in with the others because my parents wouldn't understand what those forms were saying. Also, because I spoke only Chinese at home, I saw the world through the Chinese language. There would be many times when the kids at my school would mention a certain something and I would have no idea what they were talking about. I may have actually known what that something was, but just not what it was called in English. These things made me feel insecure, and for a while, I was embarrassed to be Chinese. I wouldn't speak the language in front of people I knew outside of the family. Even long after this time, there would be some moments when I still feel that way. My parents immigrated from China, became U.S. citizens, and I was born in the U.S. But actually, I should just say that I am an American.
My name is Nancy Trong. I'm from San Francisco, and I'm in the 12th grade. I'm a student of Summer Search, a program that provides low-income kids with scholarships for 2 summer trips. In the summer before my junior year, I went on a wilderness trip. My destination was Utah for a rafting and backpacking trip. When I arrived, I was one of 2 minority students and one of 4 girls in a group of 20-something individuals. Even though my mentors prepped me beforehand for the culture shock that I would experience, I was not prepared for what was about to happen. We were split into 2 groups, and I was put with the other minority girl so we could stick together. That didn't really help, though. I tried to bond with my groupmates, but it seemed as though there was always a barrier. In the beginning, they made jokes about Asian stereotypes, but it soon escalated to mean remarks towards me. Some of them looked down on me for being poor and not white. They all came from wealthy families and bonded with each other easily and quickly. We were worlds apart. I was a Chinese Vietnamese American who moved to the U.S. at the age of 7, while they all had generations and generations of families in the U.S. They all craved foods like steak and hamburgers, while I was the only one who missed home-cooked foods like pho and fried rice. Technically, that should have been a beneficial environment where we could have learned from each other, but they never made the effort to meet me halfway. Originally, I thought I was trying to victimize myself. I thought maybe I was just being dramatic. But soon I realized that it wasn't me, it was the situation. We were all strangers, and I lacked common ground with them. Being one of the few students that were different made me an easy target for alienation. The thing that bothered me the most was how the instructors of my trip didn't step in to interfere. Although it never went beyond verbal remarks, I felt it was their responsibility to step in. There were also students who were passive spectators during the entire trip. But then again, I should have stood up for myself instead of expecting others to defend me. I like to think that I would confront them if I had a do-over. I regret not having the courage to say anything. The biggest lesson I learned was how deceptive living in San Francisco was for me. I assumed the same cultural acceptance existed everywhere. In reality, San Francisco is like a bubble. I'm glad for the wake-up call I had. One of the most important realizations was to not let one bad experience traumatize me. The conditions of the trip fostered a hostile environment, but I didn't blame my groupmates for what happened. The trip was a big influence on my decision to go to school far away. I know that I will face many situations like these in the future, and hiding in San Francisco will not help me.
Joey Yasuhiro, Winnie Zhao, and Nancy Truong are students at Washington High School in San Francisco. We'll have more of these commentaries from Washington students on Cross Currents in the coming weeks. In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you about a time your identity mattered. You can give us a call at 415-264-7106 and share your story by leaving us a message. That number again is 415-264-7106. And those stories came to us via teacher Carl Sire Ochi at Washington High School, who gave his students that writing assignment. Do you know an inspiring teacher? You can tell us about them when you call, too. The number is 415-264-7106. Give a shout-out to an inspiring teacher in your life by calling 415-264-7106 and just leave us a message, like this one.
My name is Phil Krasky, and I teach at San Francisco State University, and I wanted to share a story about my favorite teacher. My favorite teacher in the seventh grade was Mr. Chevalier. I had not been a very good student up till then, getting good grades in what I liked and abandoning what I didn't, and that depended very much on the teacher. One day, Mr. Chevalier came up to me and said, "Phil, you are wasting your talent. You're not trying, you're not interested, and you really are a talented young person. So, next week, you're going to teach the lesson in the class." I was flabbergasted. "I'm going to teach the class?" Well, I did. And because I had that challenge, not only did I read the first three chapters up to what we were learning, I read the three chapters after what we were learning. And I took it very seriously. In that moment, when I was before the class, knowing that the teacher entrusted in me this lesson, I became hooked on learning and teaching. And that's probably why I'm teaching today. So today, I try to be the teacher that I've always wanted in my classes. I try to support my students, be understanding, but I also have very high standards and challenge them to achieve. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about Mr. Chevalier, a teacher who changed my life.
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Panina Eilberg-Schwartz, Maya DePaula-Hanica, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Mu, Laura Sapinara, Ray Sue Sussman, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You'll find them online at citycarshare.org. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll meet taxi drivers learning how to share the road.
And the reason I'm talking to you as taxi drivers is because you are the ones who set the tone of the street. You're the ones who drive the most. You're the ones who have the most miles day in and day out. And you're going to be a bright color so people will be able to see your car. So you could either be this guy on the left, rah, 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 or you could be the guy on the right who's smiling and happy. It's up to you.
How to try and avoid accidents. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
I used to think that I should watch TV.
Maybe you've noticed a theme in our local music this week. It's all from Baltimore. When the 49ers lost to the Ravens last Sunday, we lost a bet with Baltimore station WTMD. So you'll be hearing the sweet strains of Chesapeake Bay all week on Cross Currents. Today we're featuring David Byrne, who was raised in Baltimore. The movie Stop Making Sense, which is about Byrne's band The Talking Heads, is playing at the Parkway Theater in Oakland at midnight on Friday. So, from Chesapeake Bay to our own bay, go Ravens. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
Everybody's in the touch of Andrew. Everybody's in the passion. Ah, the cliche.
And the world is your oyster.
They really put the cart before the horse.
This was a smoking gun.
It seems like it's everywhere. On the news.
Is this game of political football going to hurt the Democrats in the end?
From politicians.
There is no silver bullet that can bring down gas prices right away.
But not here on Cross Currents from KALW News. Tune in to our local news magazine weekdays at 5 for the anti-cliché. We'll throw stuff at you you've never heard before, like this.
I had a patient who was absolutely cured by blueberry juice.
Or this.
For now, what we want is the gooey, goopy form of life.
And we'll spare you drivel like this.
A tool in our toolbox.
Path of least resistance.
The bottom line.
Ugh, give me some more of that good stuff.
I believe that people who listen to radio are quality people.
That's what I'm talking about. Check us out weekdays at 5. We're Cross Currents on KALW 91.7.